I'd like to thank the organizers, if there is anybody out there, for this very nice meeting. And I'm sorry I couldn't get here earlier. Things are very busy for me in the summer. I've been sort of seeing what's been going on. I believe the level of the talks and the presentation in the meeting so far has been very high, and now it's about to drop for the next half hour or so, right? I'm going to show you, I don't really understand very much about, certainly not, almost nothing about quantum information, and relatively little about machine learning. What I'm going to do is summarize about 5 years worth of work that I've been doing on and off, maybe 4 years, with some machine learning friends. And it's entirely focused on using machine learning to improve the functionals that we use in density functional theory. Now, I understand the audience is quite diverse. And so I'll sort of try to summarize different bits of things and get to the latest work. So I'll do a quick review of density functional theory, and then I'll show a little example that we started with, and how that worked out rather nicely. And then I will try to get to some very recent results, which are not yet available on the web, because we're just sort of finishing off writing them up, and only one of them has been submitted. Okay, so density functional theory. So I'm only going to talk about the electronic structure problem, using density functional theory for electronic structure. And the basic problem is that you have a Hamiltonian made up of kinetic electron-electron repulsion and one-body potential for your electrons. You have n electrons. And if you think about all the systems and materials that people care about, most of the problems are just the one-body potential is a collection of nuclei. You make the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, and we know where that works and where that fails. And you often want to just solve for the lowest energy state of the electrons, the ground state of the electrons, because under normal conditions, that will tell you a vast amount of information about your system. For example, all the bond lengths and lattice structures, vibrations, all sorts of things about your system. So people would like to be able to do this in what they call a first principles manner, which is not using other empirical information about the system, but have a calculational tool where you put in just the elements and even their positions you decide by minimizing the energy and make predictions that way. So the basic theorem of density functional theory is the Homberg-Cohn theorem, and you can write it essentially in two lines. This isn't the way they did it. But if you take the minimum principle, you minimize overall anti-symmetric normalized wave functions of your Hamiltonian, you write that minimization in a two-step process, minimizing overall wave functions yielding a certain ground state density, and then minimizing overall densities. And so when you write it that way, you find that there's this thing that's called a universal functional f of n, and then you can write the ground state energy as a minimum over densities instead of wave functions. And in general, that, you know, that's a much simpler minimization, but of course all the hard many-body effects have been absorbed in this guy here. In practice, we don't directly do everything in terms of the density. What you do is you solve what are called the Cohn-Sham equations. So you imagine a fictitious set of electrons that don't interact with each other but still obey the Pauli principle. So they're still fermions, and because they don't interact, they all satisfy the same Schrodinger equation called the Cohn-Sham equation, and the potential is defined to yield the ground state density of your original system. So over here is a picture from some friends of mine, Cyrus Umbergar and Xavier Gans, for the helium atom. This is minus 2 over r in atomic units is the attraction of the two real electrons to the nuclear center. This is the exact ground state density from a quantum Monte Carlo calculation using the wave function, and then this is the exact Cohn-Sham potential for the system. If I doubly occupy the 1s orbital of this red potential here, I get exactly that density. And what Cohn and Cham proved was that you get a closed set of self-consistent equations for the potential in the Cohn-Cham scheme, writing the exchange, this small piece of the total energy, the exchange correlation energy, as a functional derivative gives you this potential. So once you have an expression for this guy, you can cycle these equations for just about any electronic system you care to mention. And you can solve this set of equations. Now, this set of equations uses these orbitals, Cohn-Cham orbitals. The original density functional theory of Thomas and Fermi actually approximated the non-interacting kinetic energy directly. And if you could do that, then you wouldn't even have to solve those equations. And then there are, of course, all sorts of different approximations written down in the literature over the decades. The local density approximation was first written down correctly by Cohn and Cham in their original paper. These days, people use generalized gradient approximations, so the local density approximation just uses the density at a given point in space. The GGA uses the density and its gradient. And then very popular in chemistry are hybrids, which mix some Hartree-Fock exchange with GGA exchange. And they are more accurate still for a lot of chemical energies. I know I'm going very fast. So the importance of DFT. Why is DFT important, right? So it spans many fields these days, right? Almost all fields that involve themselves with sort of what I call everyday matter. So it's not sort of matter in the universe and stuff like that, but the matter that we interact with every day now use DFT calculations. There is a GIGO principle. The results are only as good as your approximation for this exchange correlation energy. Garbage in, garbage out. So people are trying to come up with various approximations for this thing. And in fact, these days, there are, in some sense, far too many different possibilities. It's much faster than either solving for the wave, for a large system, it's much faster than either solving for the wave function, which is what traditionally is done in quantum chemistry, or Green's function methods that are usually used in many body physics. It's never fast enough. So on the one hand, it's much faster than full quantum solvers. On the other hand, people in biochemistry do MD simulations with classical force fields. You can also do them with Cohn-Cham DFT. It's called ab initio MD, but it's much, much slower. And you can't do long enough runs and things like that. It is often inaccurate for strongly correlated systems. So it works for a certain fraction of the periodic table and tends to fail for, in a certain sense, the other half, and including many energy-related materials. So in the US, the Department of Energy is very interested in improving it because many of the things that they care about, it doesn't work so well for. So the Fritz, the Haber process is the largest industrial process on the planet. It's the one where you take nitrogen from the air and turn it into ammonia for fertilizer. And it was that process that made it possible for China to feed itself in the 60s. That was the original Green Revolution. And for 100 years, people searched for a better catalyst for that process. Platinum was the best catalyst. It has been estimated there were 25,000 experimental attempts to find a better catalyst. And a friend of mine, using DFT calculations and a genetic algorithm, found a better catalyst. It turned out, unfortunately, the better catalyst cost $3,000 an ounce. And in fact, the industrial process is done with iron, which isn't the best catalyst, but it's certainly the cheapest. And they do it at higher temperatures and pressures. But nowadays, people are patenting catalysts found with DFT calculations, and they are being used in industrial processes. And of course, the high-pressure superconductors from a year or two ago, hydrogen sulfide, came from DFT calculations. And the important thing is that these calculations are, you try to make them quantitatively accurate, right? usually the case is that you understand the basic physics behind the problem, but the important thing is to get a very high level of accuracy in order to sort of put the atoms in the right place and in order to capture very tiny energy differences. And that's what DFT does, in a sense, very well, given its computational cost. So last year, there were 30,000 scientific papers published which used DFT calculations. So that's how big the field is. Okay, and since I'm here, a friend of mine, Axel Becke, in the chemistry department at Dalhousie, won a Killam Prize last year, the Killam Prize for Natural Sciences, for his contributions to density functional theory. He created one of the most popular functionals in chemistry. Okay. Now, one thing I work on, which I'm not going to talk about here, but I sort of bring it up just briefly, is what I call a systematic approach to density functional theory. I regard this as, one of the most important problems in basically in mathematical physics. So all these density functionals are kind of made up by what I call reverse engineering. People look at calculations and they look at experiment and they see how quantum mechanics of these electrons works, and they try to build functionals that capture the effects that they know are there. So all the approximations that we have, more or less, involve either empirical parameters or judgment calls on the part of the people who write them down. There isn't a systematic approach to constructing density functionals. For the last 10 years or so, I've been pursuing how you do that. And you can show that basically that these density functionals are a very unusual expansion in powers of H bar. And people actually knew this in the 60s, but it's sort of since been forgotten. And we've written, a dozen or more papers on this topic that are on my website. But it is a very, very difficult process to extract these this sort of series. These uniform asymptotic expansions are very tricky. But if anybody wants to talk to me about that, I'm very happy to go on and on about it. Okay. Now, one side thing here is orbital-free density functional theory. So the modern method uses this cone-sham scheme, where you construct these orbitals. And the great step forward with the cone-sham scheme was you only had to approximate a very small fraction of the total energy when you use those orbitals. And that's when it became accurate enough for solid state physics. Then later, when we had slightly better approximations, it became accurate enough for doing chemical problems. But the original density functional theory was first written down by Thomas and Fermi. And if you had a pure density functional for this non-interacting kinetic energy, you would not have to solve the cone-sham equations. And this is the rate determining step when the system gets large. Okay. Now, one other thing is you may notice one of your organizers here, slightly younger than he is now. So Miles was a postdoc with Steve and a little bit with me. And one thing we've done over the last 5 years in a separate line of work is using DMRG to create a sort of fake one-dimensional electronic structure world, which mimics that of the 3D world. And the idea behind this was to look at the performance of density functionals and discover things about them and where they work and where they fail. And you can do this sort of much quicker than with a big, huge electronic structure code that has all the bells and whistles that people need for realistic systems. And Thomas Baker is a graduate student who's pushing this forward now. Okay. Okay, so that's background on sort of DFT. Now, machine learning. So I'm no expert on machine learning, but I have friends who are. So all I'm going to talk about is kernel ridge regression, and I'm going to use that to try to construct density functionals. Now, as I mentioned, I am trying to do, in one part of my life, I'm trying to do this systematic approach where my density functionals are simply an expansion in powers of H bar, right? So what I'm about to tell you is the complete opposite of that, right? Where we're going to just use machine learning to see if we can find functionals. So I started this with Klaus Robert Mueller, who's a friend at TU Berlin in computer science, and he told me about kernel ridge regression. And there was a long program at the Institute for Pure and Applied Math at UCLA, and there will be another one this fall on sort of quantum many-body problems and machine learning, and I think there's still room in that program if anybody's interested. Matthias Rupp was his postdoc, and John Snyder was my graduate student, and because it was a long program, the pair of them were together for 3 months, and so we were able to see how to do this thing. Okay, so I always sort of test ideas by trying to do the simplest possible problem, so we try to do particles in a box. So since we only want to get, so in this project and for most of the ones we've done since then, we're simply trying to find the non-interacting kinetic energy functional. So this does not contain many-body effects. It's simply, if you know this as a functional of the density, you can directly solve an Euler equation for the density. So what we do is we take non-interacting same spin fermions in a box, say of unit length, and we put a whole pile of different potentials, 3 different Gaussian bumps downwards inside the box, 3 different ones, but then we put in lots of different realizations for 3 random parameters. We discretize space with 500 points, and we write down a kernel for the kinetic energy functional, right? We measure the distance between densities with a Gaussian kernel. It turns out the Gaussian kernel is good enough, and we construct an approximate density functional. So we generated 2,000 potentials with different bumps in the bottom of the box. We could trivially solve it exactly. We find, and we did different numbers of particles, and we find the ground state densities exactly of those potentials. And then what we do is we see, can we train the machine to give us good results. Now the kinetic energies inside the box are of order several Hartrees, and these a lot of my tables are given in kilocalories per mole. So a kilocalorie per mole is 2 millihartrees. So it's, you know, it's 2 × 1,000th of a Hartree. And what they found very, very quickly was with just, you know, something like 40 training points, the average errors were getting down to the kilocalorie per mole level, and you could drive them down as low as you liked by just using more and more data. So we separate always the data into a test set and a training set. We train on one set and we get we cross-validate and get the hyperparameters in various ways on the training set, and then test on the test set. And this worked out very well, and you could get very accurate results. So they thought they were done, but it turned out that there's a little fly in this ointment. So it's they have this machine-learned functional from examples, and it works very well for other examples from the same set. But what happens is, when you look at the functional derivative, you discover that it is terrible. So this solid line, the dashed black line, is the exact functional derivative, and this is the machine-learned functional derivative. And you can almost prove that if you do use machine learning, because you have always a finite amount of data, you have sort of results in very specific for very specific densities, that the functional derivative will come out wrongly. It'll come out badly. And so we were stuck with this problem for quite a while, and they would even try to convince me, well, this red line, sort of if you average over those oscillations, it looks kind of like the black line, right? But we thought about it, and we came up with a very prosaic answer. So we did principal component analysis on the densities that we had. So you take the densities that you have, and you construct the covariant matrix, and you diagonalize it, and you look at the sort of primary eigenvalues, and you find that only a few eigenvalues are important, and so then you project in the directions where there are these big eigenvalues. And what you're doing is projecting then, say, a functional derivative onto the manifold of densities that you have trained on. And when you do that, lo and behold, it almost exactly agrees with the exact functional derivative. So what that's saying is in the directions in which you have data, the gradient of your kinetic energy is highly accurate, and it's inaccurate in all the other directions. So then we set it up so that we did an optimized density search. So the point is, you don't just need the kinetic energy as a function of the density to replace the Cohn-Sham equations. You need to use them to find the density in the first place. And that's where the functional derivative is vital. So then we set up an optimization procedure where we always project onto these directions as we go downhill, trying to find the lowest energy, trying to find the density with the lowest energy. And I can't remember what units this was measured in, but this is an initial guess for a density. This is the exact density, and this is some measure of their difference. And you see it starts out at 10 to the 4, and then we run our algorithm. If I can see how to do it. Hold on. Here we go. And so step by step, each step is one iteration of the algorithm. And it's measuring as it goes along, and then it gets stuck. The difference between the density and the exact density. And what happens is, as it does the projection as you go along. This is not a very sort of well-defined thing, but in the end, it goes through, you know, 11 orders of magnitude and finds a density that is almost exact, not quite. So our errors are usually about 10 times bigger on the optimal density that we find this way. And in order to demonstrate that this is not your standard density functional, if you go to PhysRev Letters and you find the supplemental material, this is a tiny fraction of the numbers that are inside this machine-learned kinetic energy functional, right? So this is not something you derive on the back of an envelope, right? And there are all sorts of trouble that this causes because, for example, there are all these basic properties of kinetic energy density function, like it should always be positive. You like kinetic energies to be positive. If you look at some of the numbers inside of these things, some of them are positive, some of them are negative. I cannot prove that this thing always gives a positive result, right? On the other hand, when I apply it in the domain for which it has been trained, I always get positive results. And in fact, we could even use the variance to figure out in advance when I apply it to a density, will it or will it not give you an accurate result? Okay, so that was our first adventure in this stuff. Now, one thing that, your grandfather's local approximations, like in the Thomas Fermi theory or in local density approximation for the exchange correlation, when you stretch a bond, this is where they tend to fail. When electrons localize on two different sites, or maybe you have half an electron on one and half an electron on the other, then our standard density functional approximations, which always start from a local type approximation, go bad. And this is part of the problem with strongly correlated systems. The machine learned thing doesn't care if you've stretched a bond or not. It's just a list of numbers. If the bond stretches, it turns out it works just fine. And here we were checking that it did everything right, and it all worked fine. Yep. Absolutely, Andy.
So, in particular, in this bond breaking case,
yep.
You know, the standard thing runs into trouble because the density is the classical variable, which is continuous, and at the end, when the and electrons are discrete, right? So, in the end, when the bond is broken, you're going to wind up with an electron on one site and not on the other, and you can write a formal superposition, but any configuration really has quantized density. So, my question.
Yep.
Does this machine learning thing actually know that because it appears to know?
Right. And the answer is I have no idea, right? Because, so what it does, we train it, right? So to do this one, right, we take the bond, and we take a few data points as we stretch the thing, and it learns, right, from that. So it doesn't know, so one of the big problems is when you use this kind of stuff, these kinds of questions are, nobody knows how to answer. How does the machine know that? How do you extract patterns back out? And I spent quite a lot of time when we first got these results asking exactly that question, and I have failed totally, pretty or almost totally. That we have a few little results.
Yeah. A slightly sharper question. In lithium hydride, there is of course an asymmetry.
Yes.
So the broken thing wants to wind up with 3 and 1, which is sort of what you have. How does it work, for example, if I try to do H2-?
I show lithium hydride here, we do H2 in the paper. We could have done H2 minus, it would have been fine. Yeah, that's not an issue. Yeah, and I'll, in a certain sense, from a chemical point of view, doing the lithium hydride right was more interesting. And if you do lithium hydride with a LDA or something like that, the equivalent effect is that it won't dissociate to integer charge numbers, right? So it has that same problem in there. Okay, so then we spent quite a lot of time figuring out very clever algorithms for doing this optimization better and better. There's a bunch of papers where we do that, but always for the non-interacting kinetic energy functional and in one dimension. And one thing that you could see very clearly was very nice and that sort of came out of this at the same time was you could analyze the source of the error in the resulting machine-learned functional, and you discover that it's almost all coming from this optimal density. It's really that the density that you found by this method is not as accurate as the energy for the actual function itself. So we talk about functional-driven errors and density-driven errors. And that actually has sort of tied in with a whole other bunch of work on these things, which I won't go into. That's been important in regular DFT. So in some sense, some of the things that we're learning from doing the machine learning part of this thing are being fed back into regular DFT land. So this was from John's thesis, I think, and he had this roadmap where we were doing all these 1D problems and how we would get back to three-dimensional reality. How would we use this stuff? People in DFT really want to use it to do real applications. Okay, so the recent results that I now want to tell you about are all headed up by Lee, who is a very brilliant algorithmic guy, and he just graduated, and of course he's gone to work for a cybersecurity company, making a lot more than an assistant professor would. Felix is a student of Klaus's, and Tom does the DMRG. Okay, so there are two new papers, and I'm going to talk about both of them. Bypassing the Cohn-Sham equations. In this first one, this is what Klaus and Felix, what we're doing is showing that all this stuff works in three dimensions. So for real H2 and for real water. And then in the second one, what we're doing is going beyond just looking at the kinetic energy functional, and we're actually looking at the full interacting system and learning the full F, the universal part of the Homberg-Cohn functional. So this means we're including both the exact kinetic energy and the exchange correlation energy. And what we're doing is trying to get to the thermodynamic limit, showing that we can get accurate results for a solid, but we're all stuck still in 1D in that work. Okay, so bypassing the Cohn-Sham equations, this is a picture that they made from the paper of different maps. So here's a water molecule, these are the hydrogens, this is the oxygen. So the normal thing, if you had something like orbital-free DFT, is you have this Euler equation, and you solve it, and you get the density for the non-interacting electrons, and you have some approximation for the exchange correlation. And this is sort of what we've been doing till now. Or So if we have an orbital free guy, we do it this way. If you solve the direct Cohn-Sham equations, you do it this way. And now there's this third way, which is, which we really should have thought of before, which is instead of learning the energy as a functional of the density, we learn the density as a functional of the potential at the same time. And the point of doing that is we don't have to do a functional derivative. So in this paper, which should be available very shortly, what we do is we do machine learning. So we make a fake sort of version of the potential, a sort of smoothed out version of the potential of the atoms in the molecule, and we then train a machine learned. This is it. The machine learned. We call it the Holmberg-Cohn map. The map in the Holmberg-Cohn theorem, it proves that there's a one-to-one correspondence between potentials and densities. So we learn this directly, not as a functional derivative of some energy functional. So you have to do a vector of this density, not just the energy. But on the other hand, what we find is that you can get much more accurate answers much faster with much less training data than when you try to take the functional derivative. So what we found was when we took our methods that we'd been using in 1D and started doing them in 3D, as the dimensionality grew, I thought you were going to warn me at 10.
Sorry.
That's fine. As the dimensionality grew, the cost became. Now, the cost of learning the energy was fine, but the cost of doing these sort of optimal searches just grew and grew and grew. So in this work, we use a basis, a sort of atomic-based basis, and we learn this Holmberg-Cohn map, and it's much more accurate. So it learns much faster. So here's our old orbital-free machine learning, and this is the error in the energy due to the density, and this is going down with the number of training points. And you see when we do various variations of this Holmberg-Cohn map, they all are a couple of orders of magnitude faster in learning. So you need much less data for a given level of accuracy. So that's the important thing. So yeah, this is just we do various transformations. You do it in a reasonable way to learn this thing. And you have to, you have independent machine learning models for all the different pieces of the density. And here is H2 as a function of distance. And here is actually the error in a PBE calculation, a standard DFT calculation, as a function of the bond length. And this will get very, very large when you stretch it, as Andy was talking about. And here we do direct machine learning from the potential, but here we do it using our Holmberg-Cohn map, and you see that the errors are very small. So a lot of people have suggested learning it directly from the potential, but actually learning using the density is much more accurate. And there's a reason why DFT has been so successful so far. Okay, in the last 3 minutes, machine learning of the exact functional, right? So this is work using this 1D land that Steve and I and Lucas and Miles set up a while ago. So given that we had this machinery, I asked the question, could we learn the exact functional with all the many body effects, right? And the idea was, well, the machine still doesn't know the difference. So we just give it a bunch of densities, but we give it the exact energy, not just the Cohn-Sham kinetic energy. Now, here's an example for stretched H2. So this is all back to 1D now. And here, the green lines, we used 5 data points to learn the functional. And you see, this dashed green line is, you can see it sort of passing through the data points that we used to train it on. And then, we tested in between. And then this solid green line, so that's using the exact density. The solid green line is when we use our optimization procedure, and it gets really bad, right, to find the density, because we can, in principle, we'll do that, and you see how bad it is. On the other hand, this red line is with 20 data points, and you can't distinguish it basically from the exact curve. So it's extremely accurate. And if you look at the densities at one of the test points, you see these orange, that was green before, it's now orange, but you see it's not, it doesn't give you an accurate density, but when we have the 20 points, it agrees perfectly with the DMRG. So then when we started doing chains of longer and longer chain length in order to try to get to the thermodynamic limit, and this is where Lee came in especially, there's a trick called a Hirschfeld partitioning where you can extract the atoms out of a chain, out of a molecule. So we did that, and then what he did is a very simple representation of all the different atoms in chains of different interatomic separations, and then he does a sort of principal component analysis and picks out the seven most important components, and then he represents all the densities with just these seven components. So this reduces the cost of the calculation enormously. And what we find is, again, it's much more accurate in the bottom part than it is, especially for the longer chains, than it is in the top part. So that reduced the computational cost. And then he also trained on just the bulk, the central atom densities. And that is also much more accurate. And that's because as the chain is getting longer, you're approaching the thermodynamic limit. So in the end, we're able to get the electronic energy is a function of separation in the infinite limit very accurately. In the last picture, I don't know what happened to the resolution. Anyway, is showing as a function of the number of training data, our error getting down to 1 kilocalorie per mole, or this is 1 kilocalorie, and you can see it's converging. And these two lines, one is taking finite chains in the DMRG and extrapolating to the infinite limit, and the other one is doing an infinite DMRG calculation. And they almost exactly agree to within a third of kilocalorie per mole, and you see the machine learning is capturing it. Now, in this case, the amount of data we're using is a bit crazy. We use 50 points. So we take a chain of a certain length, and it turns out you sort of need more as the chain gets longer. And we take 50 different separations. So you could say, well, this is nuts. You have sort of separations that are only 0.2 angstroms apart, and you're using that to train, right? But the point is, once we do that, we can self-consistently find the density in between for every value and extrapolate the thermodynamic limit to 1 kilocalorie per mole. And those of you who know about this stuff know that it is very difficult to get a sort of exact solid state results to within 1 kilocalorie per mole. Okay, so these are the papers that have appeared so far, and then these other two will appear very shortly. So I'll summarize. So it works very well in these model cases, right? It's totally different than anything in DFT before. The tricky thing is finding these accurate densities, and our previous work was only done in 1D for the non-interacting kinetic energy. So these are the two projects I mentioned, going to the thermodynamic limit with the exact functional and doing the 3D calculations. And these are the people who've done the work and the funders. And thank you for your attention.
Questions?
Sorry, I went so fast.
Hi, Kieran.
There's too much stuff.
I have a quick question. So, as you mentioned, one of the in machine learning, if you have garbage in, you get garbage out. So, I imagine, if you want to have very high quality data for the training set, you need to do very expensive, as you've been trying, like exact models. Do you see actually this, in machine learning, the success of deep networks is because you have lots and lots of data. How do you see overcoming this of generating a reliable training set that is going to give you?
Right. So that's an excellent question. And so, in fact, it was my program officer at the NSF who sort of, when we were first talking about doing this, said, start with the non-interacting kinetic energy functional. Every cone sham calculation that anybody does, and every cycle within every cone sham calculation produces a data point of a kinetic energy and a density. So when you're doing the non-interacting kinetic energy, generating, having exact data is just not an issue, right? The world, actually, I heard a statistic which I need to trace down, but somebody claimed that something like over 10% of the world's computational resources are currently running DFT calculations. 10% of everything. I find that hard to believe, but if that's true, that's sort of shocking and scary. So the problem of data for the non-interacting kinetic energy is just not a problem. But I have to explain sort of how it works. So normally with DFT, you try to find a functional that applies to every electronic system. My idea with the kinetic energy is that you have a given problem, often that you need to solve very, very often with slightly different rearrangements of the atoms. And so it's that problem that you learn specifically just for that problem. So you don't try to find something universal. You just learn on that problem. And you might throw away the functional at the end of the calculation. So you do Kohn-Cham cycles, and you get data. And then you learn on that data. The machine then takes over, and you stop solving the Kohn-Cham until it comes to a situation where maybe a bond breaks for the first time, and then it goes back to the Kohn-Cham. And what's his name, De Silva in London has done this for ab initio sort of Kohn-Cham, but for the forces, not for the self-consistent density, in exactly this way, for an MD simulation of water. So then when you get to the interacting problem, which is what lots of people care about for the many-body problem, what it suggests is that you use highly accurate computational chemistry for the specific situation that you might care about. For example, van der Waals interactions, weak interactions, are very important in biochemistry. So you would collect a bunch of data on that would be highly accurate. You train on that, but then you'll get a functional which captures that effect, and you apply it for that part of the problem, but you might not use the same thing if you're working on a problem where you don't think that's important. But you would need very, very accurate data. I don't think experiment is, you know, I think that's almost hopeless, right? You really need high level. So I mentioned computational chemistry because computational chemists really know how to do that very well for small systems. And we're in the process of trying to figure this out for large systems. And of course, a very important thing would be for anything strongly correlated, you want to get highly accurate data from quantum Monte Carlo or maybe DMFT, and you use that to train the functional with corrections to your standard density functionals so that then you could run sort of large scale calculations using that functional. But it would tend to be specific to the problem that you're looking at, not these general type things that we're used to. So everybody understood everything that I said?
No, I certainly didn't understand everything that you said.
Well, there's no questions. Right?
But I wanted to ask a slightly general, slightly unfair, and slightly mathematical question. So you're learning a functional of the density.
Yes.
And the examples that you gave were either relatively small or relatively sort of periodic structures. So the general question is, because when one is doing machine learning, one wants somehow a good representation of the space of inputs of, let's say, the descriptors.
Mm-hmm.
So is there thinking about a good general way to parameterize a sort of arbitrary class of densities? How do I think about that problem? What descriptors do I want to use?
I don't think it's unfair. So I can tell you, and sort of writing these things, we sort of say this quite explicitly. If we take the last example where we do these chains, I've cheated because I keep doing chains of equal separation. I do many different separations, but they're all uniform. And so the real problem is, and I've thought about this for a long time, and only I have, you know, half a dozen approaches, but nothing that we've really tested yet. And many people have different ideas. So the real problem when you think about the applications of something like DFT is it is so diverse that it doesn't matter if you make a huge box and you put in, you know, 10 or 20 atoms or whatever, people will always want to do bulk systems or a nano thing that's 1,000 atoms on its way to being bulk and so forth. And you can ask, how do you even represent the density in a way that would capture all of this stuff, right? And I haven't addressed that yet. This is, I think, a very hard problem. It is slightly easier in one dimension because of the symmetries and things. There's much less to deal with. But if you think about regular density functional theory, it's very interesting how it solves that problem. So it starts with a local approximation. So it only uses the density at one point. So if I take a pair of hydrogen atoms, and I'm not worrying about this sort of strong correlation effects, it doesn't care whether this hydrogen atom is part of some bigger thing, if it's a bit far away, or not. It just looks at what's happening there. So this suggests very strongly that you have some kind of short-rangedness that you have to build in, right? And of course, as soon as you try to do that, you will start to run into exactly these problems of when I stretch a bond, then I get past this short-range thing, and I'll get back to these problems. So I don't have a, I haven't addressed this issue yet, right? At the moment, the systems are small enough that you can just sort of do them to death in that sense, right? We haven't solved that problem. Yeah.
Okay, one last question before coffee break time.
Sorry, I'm not familiar with DFT in general, but I see DFT as a sort of mean. So it's a tool that people use to achieve, let's say, to calculate properties mm-hmm. of the material that one cares for, right? And I was just wondering, so in this case, we are using machine learning to learn better, let's say, how to tune somehow the tools to obtain then the results. So
yes.
I was wondering, why stopping halfway? Why don't directly try to predict the properties from the material itself? So, and somehow making, because I understand.
Yeah. Yeah, so I sort of looked at what was going on this week here, right? And so lots of people are doing that, and probably, and I think Andy will talk about that, lots of people, especially in, say, this materials genome initiative and stuff in the US, are doing precisely that. So most of machine learning applications in material science are of that kind. What we're doing is way out left field, trying to use it to construct these density functionals. I mean, other people are beginning to do this now too, but so that is the normal thing. And I went through it very fast, but that's why we tested learning the energy directly as a functional of the potential. So the ultimate thing would be you would learn the energy just as a function of the atomic numbers and the positions of your atoms, right? In principle, you can do that, right? But in practice, it turns out that these are not good descriptors. You cannot figure out, the landscape is way too difficult to figure out. Well, so we do these sort of smudged out potentials and things like that, and we get it to work. But we find when we use the density as the descriptor, it is much faster, it is much more accurate. And this is sort of consistent with the fact that DFT has worked very well in the past. It sort of suggests that the density is a good a good balance between sort of accuracy and efficiency, right? And in a sense, it's all consistent with the Homberg-Cohn theorem as being the minimal amount of information needed.
Maybe.
I mean, you are, I thought, learning what is in effect the master property, which is the energy as a functional of density.
Yes, that's
that,
right.
That's in essence, he is learning a property. And the point that we know from physics is that knowledge of that particular property then allows you to infer a large range of everything else you actually want to know. I think is that a fair statement?
Well, I interpret the question to mean, so there are lots of people who might, for example, want to learn the gap of a solid as a function of some descriptor of, you know, like the lattice parameter, the bulk modulus, whatever, and actually they list, you know, 200 different descriptors, and they try to make a machine learning, regression or whatever, to predict the gap of the solid without doing the electronic structure calculation. And that's fine, and they're all doing that, and that's great, but that isn't what we're doing, right? We're trying to find the actual density functional, and the advantage that that has, along with lots of disadvantages, is that if you look at what all those other things are doing, they require you sort of to know the structure. Like, you have a database of structures and things, whereas if you can do this, you actually generate those databases, as it were, right? You can do things self-consistently, and you can do things that are away from equilibrium and all sorts of things, right? So it's much more powerful in principle if we can get it to work. Right? That's the difference, yeah.
Let's thank Kieran again.